ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, Canberra's grand finale. The long campaign to pass new environmental laws finally ends in the government's favour with a little help from the Greens. And Barnaby Joyce quits the party he once led, but what does his future hold? Was a steak and salad dinner with Pauline Hanson enough to win him over to One Nation? Our political panel of razor-sharp observers coming to you shortly. Also ahead, architects to the rescue. The New South Wales government adds new designs to its pattern book. Affordable and stylish blueprints future homeowners can flip through to choose their preferred low to mid-density design. Also, a special treat, Australia's favourite flautist, Jane Rutter. After 27 albums, her sound is as fresh as ever. That's a taste of a new album, and she'll be playing just for you. Well, first up tonight,
another turning point, a fork stuck in the road.
Today I can announce our government's landmark environmental law reforms will pass the parliament today.
It takes us forward with new protections for native forests. It takes us forward with protection from land clearing. And importantly, it stops coal and gas from being approved.
The end is right. I hope you had the time of your life.
What is very clear from the reaction so far to the dirty deal done by the Labor Party with the Greens is that this is going to put energy prices up.
So after 30 years with the National Party, I'm resigning from the party. And that really leaves me with a heavy heart.
Tattoos and memories and dead skin on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while.
What I have to do, if I'm going to continue on that fight, is get myself into a better position than the ejection chair at the backbench of the coalition in opposition.
Thank you, Deputy Speaker. Wasn't that a great example of the focus of those opposite on themselves rather than on the people they should be looking after, the real Australians who need our help?
Just asking everyone to show a little restraint.
And I wish everyone a wonderful Christmas. Across this Parliament, I wish the Leader of the Opposition, the Leader of the National Party and everyone else here a Merry Christmas.
To the Prime Minister, can I thank you for your remarks and for the courtesies that you have extended across the aisle over the year. We don't agree on a lot, but the ability to engage constructively in the national interest required very much by our democracy is appreciated by me. And I wish you, Jody and Nathan, a safe and peaceful Christmas.
It's something unpredictable, but in the end it's right. I hope you had the time of your life.
Kumbaya, the last sitting day of the Federal Parliament for 2025, and there's a lot going on. The Prime Minister leaves the House today with a smile on his face after landing a deal to pass his package of environmental protections. It's a deal 4 years in the making and finally struck in the wee hours of this morning with the Greens. And then at 1:30pm, Barnaby Joyce stood in the House of Reps and announced his resignation from the Nats after 30 years in the party. So where will he sit for the next 2 years as the member for New England? Stay tuned. I feel like saying, but wait, there's more, and there is. And to talk about it now, I'm joined from our Parliament House studios by Claire Armstrong, the ABC's Chief Digital Political Correspondent, and Nine's Chief Political Reporter, Charles Croucher. Claire, Charles, thank you very much for being here.
Hey, Fran.
Hello.
Charlie, what a day. It's been a lot of years, I reckon, since the Greens have given Anthony Albanese anything positive, anything at all, let alone an early Christmas present like this. How did the PM and his Environment Minister, Murray Watt, swing this deal?
It was almost like a reverse auction, Fran, playing off the two sides against each other. Usually you're trying to scramble for votes to bring them in. In this situation, I think we all sort of expected that something would be done by the end of the week. The question was with which side. Would they negotiate with the Coalition and find some way through there or the Greens? Instead, they've landed with the Greens. It is in two parts. It sort of flexes the government's position and electoral position following this year that says that we don't need the Coalition at all when it comes to legislation. That's one thing that this does. And the second part is the old adage that, you know, if you're not on the menu, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And that's the risk for the Coalition here, is they get dealt out of relevance if they're not there. It sort of gives them incentives for next time around there's a negotiation. And finally, for all those people that have been waiting for these bills to get through that are dense in logistics and legislative talk, but important for really important things, it's finally some certainty for industry and business and those people that want to build houses and renewable energies.
So, Claire, what did the government have to give away to get the Greens' support for this act? What was it that swung it for the Greens? Much at all?
Not nothing, particularly, you know, speaking as a Tasmanian, I think one of the things that is going to be the most hotly debated and contested is bringing native forestry into these new environmental standards, phasing them in the next 3 years. They were initially going to be exempted. And also there were some concessions around ensuring that coal and gas projects are not able to get the kind of super fast-tracked version of development approvals that is sort of part of these reforms, which were, of course, as Environment Minister Murray Watt used to talk about, as much as getting a fast yes as a fast no on new development approvals. So they're kind of the two big wins for the Greens. But the even bigger win for the Greens really is that Larissa Waters, the leader, got to stand up today and say, we are the party of, we're the opposition party of this term. And that is astonishing, really, when you think back to 12 months ago, when there is nothing Anthony Albanese would have wanted to do less than give the Greens political policy relevance, particularly in an area like environment. And here we are 12 months down the track, and he's obviously decided that that is, you know, a political capitulation worth doing. Maybe he thinks that in 2 years everyone will forget when they're back at the polls.
Wow.
But it's an astonishing turnaround.
Well, forget 12 months. 1 week, as I say, is a long time in politics. And just last week, the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, said outright to the cameras that the government preferred to get this act passed with the support of the Coalition. And he couldn't signal more clearly than that. Why didn't the Coalition go for it? Or are they just too divided to come to any kind of compromise on an issue like the environment right now?
I think divided is a big part of the problem, but disorganised, maybe even worse. The division and the distraction and the internal bickering, I think, definitely hampered the ability of the Shadow Environment Minister, Angie Bell, to kind of build any consensus. There was a lot of tit for tat between the Nationals and the Liberals. I mean, a constant complaint of the government was that every time they turned up to negotiate with the Coalition, the list of demands had got longer or had shifted, and they were back at square one because there were so many things being added last minute. It wasn't a kind of concerted, organised effort where both sides started to coalesce around particular issues. There was this kind of constant chopping and changing, even in terms of who was brought into the negotiations.
Murray Watt said that today, Fran. He said it's sort of it's hard to negotiate with someone if they don't know what they want. And that was the mentality within the government towards the opposition. They didn't know who they wanted to be the negotiator, and they didn't know what they wanted to negotiate about. And that's where the Greens seemed at least more fixed in those two positions, and that's what got the result.
If you think it through, though, in the end, is it any surprise that Labor and Greens ended up doing the deal? Because both have real political pressures on them here. For Labor, it's the hope of hanging on to any kind of credibility on the environment. You, after they approved things like that gigantic gas expansion of the Northwest Shelf, we know climate and the environment are major priorities for a lot of younger voters. That's the biggest block of voters now that Labor needs to either win or hang on to. So, you know, siding with the Greens could give them some of that cred. And the Greens have something to salvage too after they were punished at the last election so savagely for, it's understood, straying too far from their environmental roots. What do you think? Does this suit them both politically?
It definitely suits them both, but I think really Murray Watt was quite genuine when he talked about being quite happy to do a deal with either side. And it's not so much that it was a surprise in the end that it ended up being the Greens, although I did think they were sort of further away from feeling like they would find consensus initially. It's more that this conventional wisdom that if you're doing a piece of reform like this, which potentially is going to set the course of this particular area of policy for decades, you kind of want the two sort of natural parties of government to be signed on, because it is really undermining this whole reform process if one of the major like alternate government parties is effectively potentially going to go to the next election vowing to repeal or change a lot of it. And that creates the very uncertainty that business and environmental groups were trying to avoid in the first place.
Usually the pressure test comes at the next election. This time around, there isn't that much pressure on the next election because the expectations of what the result will be. So that's what gave the government more freedom to go with the Greens and sort of further bolster their climate credentials while further diminishing that of the coalition, in an area they clearly need to improve the at least electoral mentality towards them. And that is one of those is climate.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Claire Armstrong. She's the ABC's chief digital political correspondent, and Nine's chief political reporter, Charles Croucher. Charles, let's talk about Barnaby. He's quit the Nationals after 30 years. This is a party he's led not once but twice. Yeah. But he didn't confirm today, one way or the other, that he's going to join One Nation.
The souffle rising a third time seems unlikely now. Look, he didn't. In saying that, he did say he's going to seriously contemplate it. I think still all signs point towards that. It's clear Barnaby Joyce, for whatever reason, wants to stay in Parliament and in some position where he can influence decisions. It's a fair argument he's done that in this last 5 weeks by threatening to leave over net zero. I mean, he's changed the position, but that wasn't enough to keep him in the party. And the best way for him to do that would be to have a Senate seat next time around, because who knows who will have the balance of power in the Senate next time around. It may just be One Nation, and that's the easiest path for him.
Okay, so he's not telling all now, but he says he'll be sitting on the crossbench. Claire, does that mean that he's going to sit as an independent for the rest of this term, or would you expect him to be sitting in the One Nation party room when he returns next year?
Certainly when they return next year, Barnaby Joyce will be sitting as an independent. He's made the sort of commitment that he will do that for the rest of the term. Having said that, 7 months ago, he ran as a Nationals candidate. So I'm not entirely sure that I would say for sure that by the 2028 election, he'll have been an independent the entire time. But, I mean, I genuinely think that he is kind of undecided on this, and that as much as he's like enjoyed the narrative and the attention and he's used it to his advantage, I'm not sure that he had settled on shifting and that maybe that got away from him a bit, and this is actually the space that he probably needed originally to consider his future.
When he asked for that space.
And then immediately took it away from himself by giving interview after interview. Yeah.
He's been under maximum pressure in the last, you know, couple of days from his colleagues, and some of his close friends in the National Party room have come out pretty harshly against him. So when he announced his decision, he said he was sick of being in the ejection seat. Well, he seems to be placed himself a long way from some of his closest allies in the party with all of this.
He's a whole lot closer to a position of power in the seat he's in right now than the one he'll come back to. Regardless of whether it's independent or part of One Nation. 3 years from now, that might change, particularly if he's in the upper house, which is where he started his career. He said today he knows the procedures and know the way it works. But it's, yeah, I mean, it also sort of further shows the trouble the Liberal Party is having and the coalition is having. If you're losing Barnaby to the right and Malcolm Turnbull's attacking you from the left, it's sort of that broad church is getting narrower by the minute, and that's what makes it harder.
My guests here on the Radio National Hour are Claire Armstrong, chief digital political correspondent with the ABC, and Nine's chief political reporter, Charles Croucher. It's the final question time for the year, but there's still plenty of politicking and policy to go. There's MyEFO, that's the end of year fiscal snapshot, and the economic picture the government received yesterday was pretty sobering, I would have thought. Mm. How are they going to dress up the state of the economy in MyEFO when spending and debt levels are a problem, now inflation and probably interest rates are rising too? It's tricky for them, Charles.
Yeah, inflation is up. I'm not so sure that interest rates will follow just yet. Certainly the the monthly figure was bad yesterday. The quarterly figure at the end of the year, when that comes out, or for this end of this year, but it will come out next year, will be bad as well. I think the two things that the government will hang their hat on is unemployment rate, which is back down towards sort of the mid to low end of 4%. Mm-hmm. And then some of the investment numbers, particularly business investment, has come up a lot as well. So it's driving all that. The big fight, though, and this the EPBC played into it, is going to be over power prices. And there's a gas plan that has to get settled at some point from the government. That's got to get through Cabinet and be released. Then it's what you do with energy rebates, because a lot of those are coming off, and that's what's driving inflation. Now, if you argue, sure, it's artificially high, that inflation number, because it's coming off such a low base because of the subsidies, well, you can artificially lower it by putting those energy rebates back in there again, but you kick the can down the road. So that's the two big challenges on the economic side of it, hoping that unemployment stays low and you start to see some of those benefits from that productivity roundtable that we went through a few months ago.
So here we go again. And Claire, another big moment for the government comes on, I think it's the 10th of December, when the under 16 social media ban comes into effect. And there's some, you know, a challenge to the government on this, isn't there?
Yes, yeah, so we learned just this week that there will be a High Court challenge. A group called Digital Freedom Project have got two 15-year-old plaintiffs as representative young people to challenge the government's laws that are less than 2 weeks away from coming into effect. They're doing it based on a slightly obscure implied right in the Constitution, that there is an implied right to political freedom, the argument being that you are constitutionally allowed to make an informed vote, and to do that you should be able to talk about politics. And if kids aged 13 to 15 are kicked off social media, unable to engage, create content, write comments of a political nature, you are limiting their ability to access that implied right. It's a fascinating kind of test case, I suppose.
What's the vibe, as they'd say in the castle?
The vibe is, I would say, it's a very long bow, given that you're still a couple of years away from being able to vote and probably can engage in as much political communication as you like from the ages of 16 to 18. But I think the government has been waiting for someone to challenge. E-Safety Commissioner Julian Mangrant has been sort of basically saying at some point this will be challenged, whether it's when a fine is issued or before then, and now we know it's before then. But it does... I think it's interesting because the conversation that it is now creating, we had the coalition in a bit of a mess over the last 2 days with communication spokesperson Melissa McIntosh going way out on a limb saying that she reserves the right to basically withdraw support for this, which
yeah,
was then
that.
Reversed within 24 hours and no, we support the ban. But I think it just goes to show that the success of the implementation is not just going to be judged and an issue for, you know, whether it's successful in preventing young people from being on social media. But if it is messy and there are issues, it could become a political problem quite quickly for the government.
Just finally, a quick one from both of you, though it's really not a question with a quick answer. It's been a long year, but it's been a triumphant one for the Prime Minister. Anthony Albanese literally went from zero to hero, winning that giant majority in the House of Reps at the May election. Charles, what will Anthony Albanese do with that authority, that safety net?
No, that is not one with an easy answer. Look, it is long-term governing now. He's got all those things. This was going to be the year of delivery, in his words. That's pretty much wrapped up with EPBC and the social media laws that Claire was speaking about. Then it gets on to what's next legacy-wise. I think that's going to be the big things we'll start to see first in the budget, but then sort of longer term planning for the next election, given how strong the government's position is. That's when you can really start planning, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years down the track and entrench some of those things the Prime Minister wants.
And Claire, do you think he will have a crack at some very big plans or big changes?
I think he has a clear plan that he's indicated he wants to get to a point where we are very close or at a point of universal childcare and improving access to that. Beyond that, I think this is the debate that is happening, right, is his caution and the the sort of considered way that he has approached government in the last 4 years may be becoming a rod for his own back, and that at some point he might have to throw caution to the wind and actually dive in. Will he have a chance, though, if these economic kind of issues are arising and it's all about responding to those shorter-term problems? I think he'll find a path through, but for me what's interesting is whether all of the MPs sitting behind him are willing to sit there and wait, or if they will start to agitate and we'll see that kind of pressure build from within.
There's a lot of pressure from a big party room, that's for sure. Yeah. Claire, Charles, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fran.
Claire Armstrong is the ABC's Chief Digital Political Correspondent, and Charles Croucher is Chief Political Reporter for the Nine Network. And coming up, a leading light of the Australian music industry for decades, Jane Rutter is my guest.
On Breakfast Tomorrow with Sally Sara.
The deal is done. Labor has its long-awaited environmental reforms. So how is the federal government finishing up the parliamentary sitting year? For the Friday wrap of the week in politics, you'll hear from the Australian Financial Review's Phil Khoury, the Saturday Paper's Karen Barlow, and our very own Melissa Clark.
Radio National Breakfast. Weekday mornings from 5:30 or anytime on the ABC Listen app.
The Radio National Hour. With Fran Kelly.
The New South Wales government added 9 new mid-rise apartment building plans to what's called its housing pattern book designs this week. It's a move it hopes will speed up the construction of 112,000 homes in the, quote, missing middle over the next 5 years. Prospective developers can literally flip through a catalogue and choose an architecturally designed building that suits their needs. If the concept sounds a little old-fashioned, it's because it is, kind of. If you're listening to this in a terrace house right now, or maybe a California bungalow-style home, you've probably got a pattern to thank. They were a hallmark of building booms in times past, particularly after World War II. So why are we returning now to this old idea, and how will new planning reforms bring this old idea into the present? Abby Galvin is the New South Wales government architect who oversees the pattern book strategy, and Anthony Burke is the much-loved host of Grand Designs Australia, of course. He's also, though, a professor of architecture at the University of Technology, Sydney. Abby, Anthony, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks very much, Fran. Good to be here.
Abby, let's start with the sort of the number one question. What is a pattern book for housing, and how are these pattern books used?
So I think you nailed it in your introduction, Fran. They're catalogues, essentially. So they're a series of designs that sit in a book for low and mid-rise housing. All of those designs have been carefully worked through by architects and developed through a process of engineers and consultants providing feedback. So you're able to look through designs. They're developed for typical sites around Sydney. Look through the designs, work out what suits your site. And then what is very different from this pattern book from others that we've had in the past is that it's then linked to a special planning pathway. So it's able to enable you to get an approval quicker.
And so who are the pattern books for? Are they for individual home buyers, people who want to build a new home, or are they for developers?
They're for both. So the work is about empowering small and medium developers who do build most of Sydney's housing, but it's also about creating opportunities for new developers or for family and friends to partner and redevelop their own land.
Anthony, everything old is new again, and this is not the first time we've presented this way of building homes to Australians, is it? These pattern books are a thing of the past, brought back again.
That's right. We've had a lot of experience with pattern books in different stages of history. And in Australia, I think one of the first ones came out with Elizabeth Macquarie in 1809. She had 2 books in her luggage and when she arrived in Sydney. So they were brought out with her from London. So look, we've had this all along, and the pattern book as an idea tends to be a little bit cyclical. You know, it comes and goes. And you'll see, like after the Second World War, for example, there was a lot of emphasis on this kind of idea to basically address the housing crisis back then. So it's an old idea, But as Abby's explaining here, this has some differences to it, this version here, which I think are really interesting. The first one is that the diabolical side of the patent book is that they have been, in the Georgian times in particular, they were used by pretty rapacious developers, actually. So they would just use a patent, knock it out, and then sell it for the best price they could get with not a lot of morals attached to it, if you like. But the big difference here for what's happening now with the state, with the government architect, is we are linking this to the government. There's no profit motive involved. There's a whole idea of embedding the best quality design ideas into the patents from the get-go. So you're not getting a cheap product. You're getting a good price of a product that is going to be a much better design, sustainability-wise, energy-wise, material-wise, et cetera, et cetera. So the differences now are we've got the backing of the government, which actually then I kind of am most excited by the shortcutting of the approvals process that that implies. So we're de-risking the development opportunity here. And as Abby just explained, we're opening up the idea of development to a much broader pool of people. And that's pretty exciting.
Just to stay with the history for a moment, you talked about the cyclical. It's a cyclical thing, these patent books. So we tend to turn to this kind of method when we need to build more and build quickly. But you also said they're quality, so they're not quick and dirty. Australians, do we lose much with these shortcut design ideas?
Well, it's not one size fits all here. There are some really quick and dirty examples back in the day, and there are some much more elaborate versions. And even today, actually, if you go to a mass housing supplier, you'll go through some kind of interface online which will have effectively a patent book that's been digitized for you to select from. But if I think about the quality side of that that equation, I think of things like the small home service that Robin Boyd set up in Melbourne after the war. Mm-hmm. Some fantastic architects working there at very affordable prices for the every Australian idea to really re-script what a home in Australia could be. And that the power of that, to be able to walk into Myers and buy an architectural plan from a great architect across the counter, take it home with you, and then set about sort of building it, that was very impressive, really interesting kind of way to, as I said, get good design into the hands of everybody.
And Abby, is that what you've done here? Have we got the equivalent of the Robin Boyds contributing and designing these patterns?
We have. We've got a whole range of really terrific Australian and New Zealand architects working with us, and a number of them, five of the patterns were selected through an international design competition. But I think the point that Anthony makes also about the quality of the patterns and changing them is really important, because what we've done is created a process why if you use the planning pathway that we've developed, you have to maintain the integrity of the pattern. So you can't take it and change it to extremes. We define how you can change it, so how you can flex it, how you might add height, width, change bathrooms, planning, but all of those things are defined within the pattern itself. So it means that the quality is always maintained. And when I'm talking about quality, it's not just about the way the building looks, it's about the way it performs. We've been very careful about access to light, terrific cross ventilation, maintaining deep soil, tree canopy, open space, managing privacy between neighbours and between apartments within the development. So all of those things are a part of the design that we bake in, and we bake that in via the planning pathway. So you want a pattern, and to use the planning pathway, you need to sort of stick to the script.
I have so many questions and I'm interested in quality, because, you know, there have been some huge and terrible poor building standard examples in large building blocks, particularly in the last few years. I think of a lot of Australians are concerned that, you know, something that's a pattern, if you like, and churned out in quick time, relatively, you know, with cost savings in it, might be a bit shoddy. Anecdotally,
so, Fran, I would argue that it's exactly the opposite. The greater level of repetition, the greater level of certainty about a product, the more you're able to refine it and get that better and make sure that the quality is not just maintained but improved.
And what are we talking about when we're talking quality, though? Because I took a quick look, I have to say, so correct me if I'm wrong, either of you, at the New South Wales Building Code, which has a statutory warranty for 6 years for major defects and 2 years for other defects from the completion date. That doesn't instill a lot of confidence. What sort of building standards are you looking at? How long are these houses supposed to not just last and stand for, but stand for, you know, in good shape?
Yeah, well, I would be expecting 50 to 100 years at least out of the homes that we build. And that's not a big ask. If you look back at some of the older apartment buildings and older homes, I mean, look how long terrace houses have lasted, how long some of those...
I live in one that was built in 1886.
Exactly. And, of course, we have to look after them and constantly sort of improve them and take care, but their bones were good. And I think in addition to the focus on quality design that we have put into these, it's important to note that the New South Wales Building Commissioner, in response to some of those really significant problems with projects, apartment projects such as Opal Towers and Mascot Towers, have changed the building code. So they've made something specific in New South Wales which adjusts the process of how you build. You need certified practitioners to sign off every step of the way as you're developing your design, not just as you finish it. And that has created a real change, I think, in the building industry in New South Wales.
Anthony, we've all seen you on our screens looking at homes being built, looking at the quality of them, asking questions. Do you share Abby's confidence?
Yeah, I do, but I do for different reasons. I think what worries me most is when people think, look, it's all just too hard. I'm just going to go it alone. I'm going to download some YouTube video and learn how to build a house, and I'm going to crack on and do that tomorrow. What that just ignores, of course, is all the obvious stuff about the experience and the quality that you don't know what you don't know. So the patent book allows that person to kind of come in at even the low end of the market and become involved to find the ways to make things cheaper, but not lose the quality, which, as Abby says, is baked into those approvals. So I think that it's a very difficult kind of needle to thread here between the quality and the cost thing. And I mean, let's be honest, most people are responding to the cost implications of housing right now. So the quality is almost like a second order, you know, issue, if you like. But as we all know, if you stand back, we want these to last for, as Abby said, 50 to 100 years. That's what we should expect out of our homes from a straight up sort of sustainability perspective. So I think what's really exciting to me is you've given the access to this quality and a pathway to follow, which means you can kind of navigate that with some confidence then, and we can be confident that that quality will be maintained through the process.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests here today, Abby Galvin, New South Wales Government Architect. She oversees the patent book, the housing patent book strategy that's being released in New South Wales in an effort to speed up the construction of many tens of thousands of homes. And also Anthony Burke from Grand Designs Australia. Yes, that Anthony Burke, who is a professor of architecture at the University of Technology in Sydney. Abby, the patents released in July and again earlier in this week were designed to meet something called the missing middle in housing. What is the missing middle?
So the missing middle is what sits between a detached house and a tall apartment tower. So the low-rise part of the missing middle, which we're calling low-rise housing, is terrace houses, semis, a manor house, which is a two-storey apartment building, and then the mid-rise, which we often don't think about defining when we talk about the missing middle. People often think it's just terrace housing, is the 3 to 6 storey apartment building. And a 3 to 6 storey apartment building strikes this lovely balance. It sort of meets a real sweet spot in regard to apartments that are also human scaled. And they make our urban living more comfortable. And I think the other thing is that people are looking for simple buildings. They're looking for low scale, low tech, low strata costs when they're searching for an apartment and a place where you actually know your neighbour. We had research done by the City Futures Research Institute that asked people what it was that they wanted in an apartment building, and by far the majority wanted to live in a building of 20 units or less.
So was that key when you were briefing the architects and within these patterns that you're producing to develop some kind of structure, whether it's a row of terraces or whether it's a small low-rise number apartment block, to somehow enable these designs to instill some kind of sense of community or enable a sense of community?
That absolutely.
And what does that mean to the designs? How do they look?
So, we've kept them small. So the majority of those apartment buildings are 20 or less. They go from 8 units in a building up to 20. We do have some large lots for greenfield development, but they have communal spaces. They have rooftop gardens. They have generous circulation outside your apartment so that you might not necessarily want to spend the whole day hanging out with your neighbour, but you've got a spot that you can have a chat with them as you're just about to walk in or out of your space. So it's about making sure those communal spaces are really positive and active. And, you know your neighbour. When you think about a really large building, long corridor, A, they're not conducive spaces to talk and to meet, but often they can be quite alien in regarding to knowing who's in your building, because you might be in a very large building with a very long corridor and not a lot of natural light. So these are beautiful light, lovely ventilation, green spaces, rooftops, gardens.
And Anthony, how important is that, do you think, for architects generally to take into account the impact of what they're designing in terms of community? And was that notion of building something where people would may be able to develop that sense of community was important in some of the pattern book building in the past?
Yeah, not so much, not in the past, not until about the 70s in the UK when we started to get more of an idea of social housing and so on, even though we're talking about row houses in the Georgian period, for example, but that wasn't really about a community as such. It was more about individual lots that happened to be more efficient by building them close together. So I think that's another one of those differences here in this version of the pattern book, is that that community scale, the neighbourhood scale, is really present in every single design. And as we all know, there's so much research which says why that is an important thing for us to be sort of moving towards. What I like about this, it means that the patterns themselves then by default sort of embed community, or the possibility of community, if you like, within the designs for the individual home. That's a really hard bridge to kind of get, I guess, to make. Mm-hmm. Link those two things together in a way that doesn't put off either side of the equation.
I think the other thing that's important about the designs is that they're thinking about apartments as forever homes. So we generally consider apartments as investment products. 70% of apartments are owned by investors. And this is enabling that scale of development that can consider you living in an apartment forever. I mean, you might change the scale. You might go from a one bedroom to a two to a three, but an apartment is something that you can imagine living in for your life rather than having to search for something else, and it not just being the two-bedroom, two-bathroom investor product.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Abby Galvin, the New South Wales Government architect, and also Anthony Burke, host of Grand Designs and Professor of Architecture at UTS. We're talking about these housing pattern books that the New South Wales Government have produced. They're an old idea, and they're being revived here, designed by architects, for the express purpose, Abby, I think, of, yes, making the whole approval process quicker, faster, and make sure people get forever homes and high quality homes, if you just told us. But what is the process for people? How much will it cost? You know, people want to know, what will it cost? What do I do? How long will it take me to get my home? What's the process and the benefits here for people in those sort of tin tack terms?
The benefits and the savings are where we've done a whole lot of work already, so that a developer or a potential user of the patterns don't have to do that work. So you still have to do a bit, but you go to the pattern book website, whether you're looking at low rise or mid rise, you search through all of the packs. There's a lot of detail and a lot of information you're able to download for free. You can test those with your design team against your site to see what works, and then you purchase a pattern. A pattern to purchase at the moment, the low rise are $1, and the mid rise are $1,500 for the small lots and $2,500 for the larger lot patterns. And when you purchase, you get a whole series of CAD drawings, which is computer drawings, mm-hmm. As well as a unique number. And that number is what you use as you're putting your planning application in. So you don't need to pay anything to download them all and have a good read and review of them.
Okay. But you can buy one for $1, then you still have to go through a planning process that will cost you. And do you have to get architects on board at that point?
You do. So if you're working on low rise, you can get a building designer or an architect to do the work. Mid-rise apartments require, by law, an architect to do your development application and to sign off your drawings. So you'll need to get an architect to then develop and modify. But they've gone all the way through from a design perspective up to a development application level. So there's a huge amount that's been thought about already. So a lot of those complexities that you find in design and building have been sort of cracked for you already. So we've had structural engineers, traffic engineers, mechanical, electrical, waste, fire, all sorts, as well as the architectural teams who have provided advice that have contributed to these designs. So you take that, you modify that to suit your site. Unfortunately, we can't do a development application for someone because we don't know where their site is and the size it's going to be, but we have taken a whole lot of data to understand the typical site and lot sizes across New South Wales and applied the patterns to those typical lots and then shown how you might modify them to suit.
Anthony, it sounds like such a great idea. It sounds so accessible for people in terms of, you know, funding. You don't have to pay architects huge amounts of money because much of this work's been already done. How come we stop doing it in the first place? Why did we ever stop producing these kind of pattern books?
Well, I think the main thing is that the pattern books were done by individual architects or individual companies in the past. So they were just, a developer who had some designs. They thought they were good enough to put into a catalogue and then market those as ready to go, you know, off the plan kind of drawings. And the difference here is that we've got the government buying, which means the pathway of all the other stuff which sits around all this is what makes the big difference here. So, you know, those smaller companies, when they were doing it back in the day, they would sell their plans until they went out of fashion or went out of business. And of course, once they'd built the house or once they'd sold the plan, their sort of duty of care was, well, you know, there really wasn't one. So that's very different to here, mm-hmm. because those relationships to the local the LGAs and all the rest, there is like a regulatory framework that sits within, that's embedded within these patterns. So that duty of care, if you like, to both the individual and the larger social context is sort of already written into the patterns themselves.
Abby, would you expect other states to follow this model?
So interestingly, Victoria started it a few years ago already, and they developed
four patterns. Beg your pardon, Victorians, ahead of the curve.
So yes, we've got great colleagues down in Victoria that have done some of this already. But they started in quite a modest way. They did four designs, so they developed four patterns through a competition. And that's for three-storey apartment buildings. I think what's important to note about the Victorian scheme is those apartment buildings were designed assuming you had two sites that you were required to amalgamate. And we've been very conscious of making sure that all of our patterns can be designed for single individual sites.
We can all be developers, ain't that grand?
We could be developers, and I think that's what's actually really exciting about it, is that it opens the market up to people who might not even have contemplated doing something by themselves before.
And Anthony, what do you reckon? Are we going to see any of these pattern houses feature on Grand Designs?
You know, I'm optimistic. I'm talking to the producers. I think there's something in it. What do you think, Fran?
I think there's something in it. That's why I'm talking to you. Abby Galvin and Anthony Burke, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Fran.
Abby Galvin is the government architect in New South Wales, and Anthony Burke is the host of Grand Designs Australia and Professor of Architecture at the University of Technology, Sydney. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. The flute, it's one of the oldest musical instruments known to mankind. The first example dates back around 40,000 years. My next guest, flautist Jane Rutter, hasn't been around that long, but with 27 albums under her belt, she is definitely a mainstay of the Australian music landscape. Her collaborations have pushed boundaries, surprising listeners and expanding the typical repertoire for this instrument. Her new album, Meditations on Australia, launches tomorrow, and I'm pleased to say that Jane joins me in the studio. Jane Rutter, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Hi, Fran. It's so great to see you again. I was dancing in the streets when you came back on air.
Well, thank you very much, and it's so great to have you back on the show. Your latest album, Meditations on Australia, we're just going to hear a little bit now. Jane, your career has taken you around the world. Mm-hmm. It's endeared you to audiences in France and Italy, Brazil, other places. Does this album, Meditations on Australia, feel like a return to your Australian roots, to your homeland?
Yes, it's a deeply personal journey for me, this album. I suppose it's a sort of sonic exploration of this incredible country, which I've been so blessed to have been brought up in. When you think about it, how did I get so lucky? How did we get so lucky to be out of 8 billion people to live in this country, which has so many things to offer? I presented on Getaway for a year. I've travelled all over Australia with my concerts and also my TV appearances. I've got a very deep connection to the Australian bush. My father was from a very poor working class family in the Bega Valley, and we used to walk up and down Tathra Beach. He was a lifesaver, and he taught me how to fish and surf and swim. And I've always had this deep connection to country, nurtured in me by both my parents, and also more recently, I suppose the whole album Meditations on Australia is a reflection of the Indigenous deep listening, which Miriam Rose Ungama Bowman calls dadiri. And there's this a sense of deep listening that I have, I believe, when I play my flute, which strangely enough, when I went to France to study in Paris with Jean-Pierre Rampal, I found that they also had this sense of a deep love of the unity of everything, which is conveyed in the French sound.
So tell me a little bit more about all that, because it's a big idea, Meditations on Australia. What were you hoping to capture about Australia with this album?
I suppose the enormity of the continent and this huge possibility that we are nurturing within Australia in spite of problems, of Australia being a cultural treasure vase for the rest of the world, that within the expanse of the continent there's rainforest, there's sea, there's desert, there's the mud mosques that were made by the Afghan cameleers in the Simpson Desert. And I wanted to encapsulate my own feelings sonically to portray my sense of the country, and also to encourage other people to meditate on the possibilities of the paradise that Australia is, and to really rejoice in that. We should be brimming in with joy about living in this country, I feel.
There's a lot of improvisation on this album. Is that unusual for you?
No, not at all. In fact, I went to the Conservatorium High School and I met a colleague, John Huey, with whom I've done several albums and released a couple of singles on his album this year. And John was primarily a jazz composer, and we worked together from about the age of 18. And then Don Burrows was one of my mentors, and he encouraged me to improvise. I love the idea, and have all my life since then, the idea that as a trained, highly trained classical player, I can pick up my flute and play music that is straight from the heart and from my soul without needing another composer. But also, when I'm playing a composer, I try to incorporate that that I'm sort of mind-melding with the composer.
I have to say it's an extraordinary gift. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is Jane Rutter, a world-renowned flautist. She's just launched her new album, which is called Meditations on Australia. And do stay with us, because she's going to play just for you, the Radio National Hour audience. You've been around a long time. You and I on the radio go back a long way too. Yeah. I remember clearly interviewing you, I think it was 2016, when you were awarded the, now stay with me on this, Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et Lettres.
Pretty good, Fran.
For the rest of us, that's the Knight of the Order of the Arts and Letters, an incredibly high honour in France. Yes. France has been a big influence on your work, hasn't it? You already mentioned that you studied in Paris with Jean-Paul Rampal and others, and you're a proponent of the French flute school. What is it about France, about French culture, that suits you and the flute so well?
Well, France and Paris are known for their music and the arts and impressionism and the effect that that's had on the whole of the rest of Western society, really. And the flute is almost like a national hero's instrument in France. I was lucky enough to arrive in Paris at the age of 18 and managed to learn with Jean-Pierre Rampal. The Rampal French School is my credo, because with this type of playing, and I don't think there are many of us left who actually play with this kind of emotional intent, the idea is that the listener and the player embraces the music in a very tender and affectionate way, whilst at the same time being technically brilliant and completely it's almost like a Zen thing. It's almost like a quantum field thing where the emotions, the intellect, the physical and the spiritual all come together. And it's true that people have, over my long career, I've been working as a professional since I was about 17, people have told me that my albums have been there when they've been given birth, or as a soul, a parent or an older person in their family departs this earth to another manifestation, that they're listening to my music. And it's just an incredible honour to feel that my sound can truly embrace people and make audiences and listeners feel that, yes, we are all one and we all belong, and that we're in this together, and that we should support and help each other. I know I'm sounding very sort of Pollyanna-ish, but I really truly believe this. I've been so blessed to have been given this gift. Amazing flute teachers in Australia who then sent me to France to flourish. And when I was in Paris and I had these flute teachers who said, oh yes, make me cry with your flute. You can be the Scheherazade of the flute and make love to the world with your sounds and stories. I mean, and they, of course, meant tears of joy, of course. But what an incredible thing to say to a young person to inspire them. And it's been great. I mean,
have you internalised that? Do you feel like you're making love to the world when you're playing?
Yes, I really do. And when I'm having a really crappy day, I pick up my flute and I play and I think, oh, thank God I'm me. And it's just, I mean, I suppose sports people have this when they're in the zone, but this is the great gift that the Rampal School gave to me with those years in Paris.
How great.
And I've been lucky to pass it down to other players too. It's been incredible.
I want to talk a bit about that. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is flautist Jane Rutter. She really needs a little introduction. She's had 27 albums to her name. She's just launched this new one. It's called Meditations on Australia. As I say, the new one is album number 27. Yes. Talk about a long career. It's
some
incredible.
Some of them have been compilation albums, but, yeah, that's what we've clocked up. Yeah.
You've also performed across such a wide variety of forms, orchestral collaborations, chamber music, intimate salons and styles, Latin, classical, Irish folk. Do you have a favourite?
No, not really. I mean, my favourite is whatever piece I'm playing at the moment, because let's face it, we only
now have... That's sounding very Pollyanna.
No, I know. But, you know, we only really have the moment. I mean, yesterday's gone. The future hasn't begun yet. We only... Having a happy life, I think, means having a happy day. And it's true that I think all the really great musicians say, if you say, what's your favourite piece, you have to say it's the piece I'm playing.
Yeah.
Because it's a proper reflection of who you truly are.
Jane, you also conduct workshops, you've talked about mentoring. In recent years, you've created the Live at Lunch concert series in Sydney, which is sort of, you know, outside your frame as a flautist. Is all this your way of giving back, and how important is that to you now at this stage of your career?
It's terribly important. I mean, I think when one is younger, your ambition can drive you, and I'm still ambitious, but my ambition is more to reflect gratitude now. Yeah, I'm grateful. I'm very grateful.
We've been talking about your new album, album 27. Now I want to talk about album 26. It's called Amore. The clue is in the name. It's you're going to play us a piece. You've got Giuseppe, your guitarist, Giuseppe Zangari here, who recorded this album with you. Tell us a little about the piece you're going to play.
I wanted to do an album with Giuseppe. We've been performing together for some time. The piece that we'd like to play for you now is called Gabriel's Oboe, which we first played during COVID and was very poignant for us. It's my version of it, really, or our version, in which, well, I don't play the oboe. I start on my gold concert flute and I swap to whistle, Irish whistle. And so maybe we should subtitle it Gabriel's Whistle.
Well, it happens to be one of my favourites too, so I'm looking forward to it. Jane Rutter, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much too, Fran. It's just lovely to be back.
That was flautist Jane Rutter. And you can find Jane's new album, Meditations on Australia, on all your favourite streaming platforms from tomorrow and on her website, janerutter.com. Well, that's the show for this evening. As ever, thank you so much for your company. In a moment, some flute to serenade you into the night. And tomorrow we'll have music too. Kylie's interviewing the Peruvian tenor Juan Diego Flores. But right now, here's Jane Rutter and Giuseppe Zangari playing Gabriel's Oboe by Ennio Morricone from their 26th album, Amore. I'll be back with you on Monday. Have a lovely, lovely night.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.